Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I hope you've all had a wonderful summer. It is great to be back online. Tonight, I am very excited to say that I have a phenomenal guest in Tom Clute, who we are going to spend a considerable amount of talking about his extensive experiences throughout the years and his work and his insight and what he has to offer. An extraordinary time that this will be. Tom, are you online?
Yes, I am, Lauren. Thank you.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm good, thank you. It's pretty good weather here, still sunny, and Vancouver, Washington, not too bad, can't complain.
Vancouver, Washington. Well, nice to hear from the other side of the country. That is just something else. So I'm just looking at your bio, which I just posted online and for people to check out. So I understand that you are a honorably discharged disabled U.S. Air Force veteran. And I want to thank you for your service, and that you are from the Northwest, and since 1970 you've resided off and on in Vancouver, Washington, since 1988, and you've had just extensive experience in different areas, and so I'm wondering if you want to just jump in and let me know where you'd like to start the conversation, or if you have a specific thing that you would like people to know before we get started, that would be great.
Lauren, if you could just give me kind of a brief context of what, and I apologize for I didn't do enough research on your previous guests and what your normal routine is, but if you just give me kind of an idea so I can be in alignment with that. And then
no,
I'm going to give a little
no
bit of
normal. There's no normal. There's no normal. It's entirely into where people are, and sometimes we just jump right into people's perspectives on things. Sometimes people give a little bit of background of where they're coming from. So whichever you prefer. I mean, I'm quite interested in some of the healing work that you've done and would really like to hear about that journey. But perhaps people might want a little bit of background before we jump right in there. And so if you'd like to tell people a little bit about your history,
sure. That would be
what
great.
Brought you to doing then, what you do now, how you went about that.
Okay. Sure. Well, thank you, Lauren. And then, so basically you're hosting me as a guest on your show, and then at some time before we end, we're going to have opportunity for discussion or questions, or how do you normally do that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that people will call in, and if at any point people want to ask a question or have some kind of input, they'll press 1 online to let me know that they want to jump in on the conversation.
Okay.
But generally, we kind of get our feet wet a little, let
yeah.
people know where
okay.
You're coming
right.
from,
sounds good.
And then open up
so,
a bit. Yeah.
I'll go ahead and jump in.
Great.
Okay, again, this is Tom Clute, and I live in Vancouver, Washington. I moved to Portland in about 1970 with my family. I'm a preacher's kid from a fundamentalist Christian background, Seventh-day Adventist to be specific. I grew up in private Adventist grade school and high school, and then I jumped into the secular world at Portland Community College. Took quite a bit of journeys to finally land a master's degree in social work, preceded by a bachelor's degree in social psychology. And I tried nursing and occupational therapy. Those are two careers that they were more medically field-oriented, and so I found my niche in social arenas, and so the social work actually was much stronger. But my deepest love is psychology. And then I found an emerging field that Dr. Jean Houston has spearheaded, and that is in the realm of sacred psychology. So I just love that that venue.
What kind of psychology is that? Just in
sacred psychology. It's a new coinage, probably maybe 20 years old or something. I haven't done deep research, but it's a relatively emerging field. Actually, the term sacred has quite a few domains it affects. Perhaps we could just say universal, but for example, sacred ecology, sacred economics, sacred geometry, and those kinds of things. And so those are very common themes. And so that's a tremendous topic right there, Lauren, to dive into, but I won't yet. But I'm just saying that my research and exploration has really been a tremendous blessing for me to shape my own worldview over an extended, I'd say, 3 decades. And so anyway, that's really cool. So I'd like just sharing that psychology is really my deepest love. But I like the social work venue as well because it has a taking into consideration very mindfully and comprehensively how the environment impacts the individual and that interface, because it's so easy, from my experience, I'm sure others, to be labeled and marginalized and blaming the victim, all those things, because mainstream or people that don't have a history of being able to have empathy for someone else's experience, whether it's homelessness or mental health issues or incarceration or whatever, if they don't have that experience, then all we can do is fall back into judgment, because that's all we have. So anyway, so I like the social work, more comprehensive, they call it a biopsychosocial component, and then actually spirituality has been an emerging field in social work for at least a decade now, so it's actually biopsychosocial spiritual. And just as a side note, Lauren, to give you an idea of how important social work is at the VA, Veterans Administration, they have more social workers than any other employer, as far as I know. Of course, they're the largest employer in the world for they're the largest integrated medical system in the world. So that's just massive. I think
so that is failing people left and right, right?
Yeah. Pardon?
I said that is failing people left and right.
You know, I acknowledge that, and yet it's not completely failing. I am here to be, and this is a different conversation. I mean, could elaborate later, but I actually have quite a bit of praise for my personal experience as a patient in the VA. It's been extraordinary for me. It made a big difference and continues to. So I acknowledge that the VA is a big bureaucracy. But there are people in the VA that absolutely give their heart and soul to serving our veterans, and I just have high praise for that, simultaneously acknowledging the limitations and the trauma that humans do with each other because we're all imperfect. So, okay. So I think a little bit of
people died waiting for services, and so we don't let that exactly go, that there's plenty of issue within it. But, okay, so.
And I want to say, Lauren, I haven't listened to a lot of your shows yet. I know that you have extensive, incredible mastery and knowledge of the pathology of our mental health systems. Is that correct?
I don't know about that, but I've got a lot to say about them. So I do think that's it. But I know that in the general news and not concerning the mental health system of the VA, but concerning just the VA's health services, that dozens of people were left dying, that they created false wait lists, that that it was not limited to just one place, that this was an extensive problem of vets coming back and not being given services and winding up dying waiting.
I acknowledge that. I don't follow the news. I don't watch the news unless I happen to see it somewhere. I do see the papers once in a while, but that's my choice. I choose to try and stay as toxic-free as possible. And for me, the the news is just inundated with, I hate to say this, but propaganda from one point of view, and just skewed information. They're all the, you know, there's a wonderful thing that Rogers, Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, his name's Jim Rogers, and his mom, he said his mom shared with him, when you feel discouraged and you feel like the world is just too painful, she said, remember all the helpers out there. And I just don't see the news really adequately expressing that, but there are so many helpers. It's overwhelming. I mean, anyway, so that's, I don't mean to argue, but I'm just saying that I try and protect my shields. You know, like in a Star Trek, I've tried to put up my energy shields and protect my my posture and my orientation and the way I approach life, because, I mean, we all have enough challenges. I don't need to load more negative into my system. That's just how I feel.
Yeah, and unfortunately, this is an ordinarily a current event show, so it's kind of hard to escape the news, and it's amongst me on a regular basis.
I can
see how anyone can think that the news is toxic, and it certainly is often agenda-driven. So there's no two ways around that. Okay.
But
so,
I can give you more background. I tend to – so go ahead. I was going to give a little more history first.
Yes, that would be great.
Okay. So, let's see. You know, I'm going to focus on starting at age 22 was when I transitioned from Portland Community College up to the University of Puget Sound and took the occupational therapy program. That was a significant life event and very impactful. I failed that course, the medical terminology and the neurology and all those things just could not handle that. I liked the social aspect, so I failed that. And in December, I moved back with my mom. In the meantime, my parents had divorced, so just the whole family structure was splintered and pretty much, you know, the house was sold and everything, so we didn't have a family unit anymore. And that was very traumatizing for me and for my mom. Things took me about a year and a half to unwind and try and figure out up and down. And after about a year and a half of little part-time jobs here and talking with quite a few people, I finally decided to interview the military recruiting station here in Vancouver. And I talked to a couple of them. I decided to go in the Air Force because I thought, well, their basic training probably is the least traumatizing. I might be able to make it through that. So I chose that, and so as I reflect back, Lauren, on the decisions I made, that was one of the pivotal decisions that I look back and see that was an independent choice that I made, and I really hadn't stood up on my own two feet too much until that point, but I realized that my mom was still in her own recovery and trying to regain her balance from the divorce and things. And so I realized I have to take care of myself. No one's able to do that. And so that was a defining choice. The basic training was very hard. I had a lot of symptoms, but they put me in a support group called the Airman Support Group, which for, the basic training troops that showed that they could make it through if they had support. So I did that, and then I got to my duty station in Whiteman Air Force Base, Missouri, and that was very hard but very helpful. So again, for me, the choice to go in the Air Force was a pivotal decision, and then for the last 20 years is actually my 20-year point that I've been with the VA for that long, and it has been quite a journey. A fair amount of medical model, but also more recovery focused over the last few years. So I got out of the Air Force in 1993. I was in there from 89 to 93. And then I went over to Desert Storm before I got out for 3 months as a plumber and so provided water support for the base and things like that. And that was in Dahran, Saudi Arabia. And then I got out and went back to nursing school, and that was I bombed that, and then the counselor at the Clark College said, "Well, you're a vet, so if you really need help, or if you find yourself being depressed, then you can, the VA hospital is there. So I did get very depressed, and I ended up not wanting to kill myself, but at the same time, I didn't want to live anymore. I just wanted to sleep all day, and when the morning came, I was a dread to have to face another day. So finally, I called the VA, and I went in there for stabilization about 2 weeks, and that was the beginning of my VA experience. And then I was in several facilities after that for several years, off and on. Really rough ride, but I became homeless after I stopped being a nurse's aide in 1999. I was a nurse's aide from 97 to 99, and then went to sales, you know, with the life insurance and bombed that, but I was determined, and so I just became homeless. But anyway, and then I went to the VA care again to get more support, and I got in their housing, and then I was qualified for their education, Chapter 31, so I got my master's degree in social work. And then I was able to hold down jobs for a little bit here and there as a dialysis social worker for a year and a half in Corvallis for the hospital system, and then I came up here after, it's a long story of being in a relationship and having a divorce. And then I came back to Vancouver and regrouped with my mom, and then got another job in mental health services that lasted for a year and a half, and I lost that job. My productivity, I wasn't able to keep up with in the mental health services field, just a high productivity and things. And I wasn't efficient with computers, so I sadly found out that being a caring person, yeah, it's an important component, but it's about productivity and all those things. So I had a lot of issues with that. But anyway, so I'm currently reinventing myself. I am on disability with the VA, and then I also recently got on Social Security. I didn't want to, but I went to get help to get unemployability, and the attorney said, well, it would support your claim to get Social Security. So I reluctantly did, and I was approved within 4 months, which surprised the hell out of me. But it really did help because I was scraping bottom every month and stuff like that. So anyway, now I'm finally in an apartment and stable housing, and I've been working on reinventing myself as a speaker and writer, and now I'm just coming into developing, you know, kind of going back, reflecting on stories, signature stories I can develop, and then I've done a lot of Facebook posts and writing and things, but it hasn't been that organized yet, so now I'm in the process of moving from a high level of chaos the last couple of years in terms of my own recovery into more coherence over the weeks and months. Okay, so I hope that gives a little bit of background. I'm happy to flesh out any areas you'd like to hear, but that's kind of a fast, rough sketch.
So my question is, how did you get involved with, because it's my understanding that you've been involved with peer and stuff and doing
Can you speak a little more clearly, please?
It's my understanding that you've been involved with some peer run stuff and doing alternative types of things, and so I'm just wondering how you got there and what those things are.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I do have a fair amount of peer experience. So my peer experience started when I was going to a mental health recovery community here in Vancouver called Consumer Voices Are Born. It was started about 15 years ago in Vancouver by individuals identifying as having a lived experience. And so they formed a nonprofit. And then when I came along about 5 years ago, I found it, got interested in it, and became involved. And then from there, I heard about peer support and that I could get the state certification week-long training. So I took that in 2010, and then I was able to get employment in 2011 with a Portland-based, very strong advocacy peer-driven model that worked in collaboration with existing mental health services, but they had a real strong self-determination model and really honoring the person's voice while they were continuing to get their psychiatric services and social support. So it was really quite an awesome tandem partnership. And so that was, I did that one, and then I got another peer support position in Portland with an organization called Folk Time. They were a socialization and a day center for people with mental health experiences and disabilities. And I heard about a position there, and then they were just emerging into the peer support, and that was actually the model they took their training, and that was intentional peer support. So I took that, and that was really good. I really enjoyed that. So I worked there for about a little bit less than a year, and then unfortunately I was let go. But that's my background in that. While I was employed there, though, I did go to the Alternatives Conference in Portland, which was extraordinary, and expanded my network there and learned more about peer services. And then there's also an organization here in Portland that is a technical assistance for peer-run services. I can't remember the name of it right now. I might think of it later. But they serve like 3 or 4 states. So it's a SAMHSA grant that they have been given the green light to run that program, several programs actually.
I see. Sorry. Okay. So that's where you're coming from. And so I'm just wondering, this sacred psychology that you were talking about, would you be willing to give a little bit more of a backing into it of where it's coming from? And then also, I'm just looking at some stuff that you had sent me earlier about this idea of toxic knowledge. I don't know if you could talk about this in terms from the idea of compulsory or for your own good. And you had just sent me some notes that you were looking at the difference between toxic knowledge and nourishing knowledge, I guess.
I kind of made that up on the fly. But it just, those things happen. They emerge for me. I'm a creative writer and thinker, but that made sense to me. So I'm happy to share about that.
And I just want to also just give out the phone number just in case people don't have it and would like to call in. It's area code 267-521-0167. If you'd like to join in the conversation, area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, it's area code 855-346-3351. Okay. So, yes, please, continue.
Thank you. You know, Lauren, one of my intentions for spending time with you this evening and your audience, your loyal followers, was I really wanted to slow down and come into sharing from a heart space some things that have been helpful for me, and I will do my best to integrate that into some stories and then some sharing some research things that have really made a difference for me, and I hope that they can provide some hope and possibilities for others to check out. So
great.
With that in mind, you asked about the sacred psychology, and I really hadn't heard that term before except through Dr. Jean Houston. She is one of the major, most extraordinary minds on the planet, as far as I'm concerned. I forget his name, but he invented the geodesic dome, and he said her mind was a national treasure. She had the chance when as a child to spend time with, I can't say his name properly, but Till Chardin, I can't remember, but anyway, he's just an extraordinary spiritual teacher and luminary. And Dr. Jean Houston has written close to 30 books, and some of the more recent ones. I have one sitting right here called The Possible Human. She has another one that is focused on sacred psychology, and that is titled, think for a second, I'll have to come back to that, but it has to do with sacred psychology. So I think, I don't know if she's the only one that coined that, but so anyway, Dr. King Houston is a definite teacher and trainer. She's created several programs worldwide. A more recent one is called the Social Artistry, which is an extraordinary training. And then she also had some other extraordinary trainings. I can't remember the names of them right now, but it's just jeanhouston.com. We'll get you there. Okay, so sacred psychology. I'm going to pause. Okay, this is important for me to share. Thank you for asking.
Sure.
So I'm going to open up the two words, sacred and then psychology, and I'm speaking from my own being an American, growing up in a Western society with the Socratic method and the philosophy that I've inherited from classical psychology. So my understanding of the psychology I received in my training was very deductive. It was empiricism based, and another word I learned recently epistemology. I Googled that, and that means the philosophy of the study of knowledge. And so the word sacred, for me, I didn't get much sacred except in religion, which to me was anything but sacred. Sorry about that, but I don't mean to poo-poo that. But my experience of the sacred was very traumatized for me personally. Anyway, didn't want to go there. But anyway, so back to so I'm just giving a little framework that traditional psychology is very evidence-based, very empirical, the study of knowledge, study of science. We're very, very dependent on replicating studies and proving things, which can be problematic because everything that can't be proven is is disallowed or it's not given value. So all the indigenous wisdom, all the ancient, all those things are lost from my experience. So the sacred, so this is go back to my last couple of years of my research, Lauren, has come into a shift into an integral spirituality, an integral worldview. Some names that come to mind for me include Ken Wilber, who has some books, 20 books plus, and one of them was called The Theory of Everything. But it's an integral philosophy. And then more recently, some works by a physicist, and he theorized quite powerfully on the unified field theory. And then also a lot of physics and astronomy, just a new science, you might say. So I'm trying to wrap around sacred and this little background for that. So for me, sacred, I have splintering thoughts, but I want to talk about a shift from separation mechanistic worldview that the history of our knowledge, westernized society, and now physics and astronomy and so on is coming into an integral, or as even Dr. Albert Einstein, he has lots of wonderful quotes. One of them is, he says that our task in life is to basically, I forget the exact words, but to challenge or to break through the delusion of our mind of separation and come into compassion and a appreciation of the whole of life. And so this whole idea of sacred for me is this healing of this massive rift of a fragmented, fracturing worldview that's based on mechanistic historical developments of the Western world that I'm familiar with. And so me, like the integrated medicine and then the more holistic, it acknowledges that there's something called coherence and connectivity and holism. And so those are very opposing, juxtaposed worldviews. And so we're going through a lot of transition now. So there's a lot of suffering because of this fractured rather than integrated or integral philosophy. Okay, so that's the background for me of sacred is coming into, for me, Lauren, I can breathe into deep gratitude when for me it's been a theoretical shift intellectually, and then over time I breathe into that and then my emotions catch up with that. My intellect can embrace it piece at a time, and then my emotions, and then I come into deep gratitude, and it's a rough ride. It's not instant or anything, and I, you know, disillusionment within gratitude and things, because I'm peeling off layers of knowledge that were imposed on me and that I inherited, and now, but it's coming into reading this unified, this integral. I wasn't familiar with that. I wasn't familiar with the Tao or the Tao Te Ching or, you know, Taoism, which to me is very sacred, and they call it the integral, the great integrity. Are you familiar with the Tao Te Ching, Lauren?
Not well enough to talk off the top of my head about it, not even a little bit, no.
Yeah. Sometimes
sorry.
I have so many ideas I'm trying to share that sometimes get fragmented, and I apologize for that.
No, there's nothing to be apologizing. I think that it's really giving the breadth of what we're talking about here, and this idea, though, of spiritual connection to gratitude, to being able to reach out beyond and have some kind of integral experience, I think is coming through. I just Googled off of, sacred psychology and just looked. And so what I'm finding is that it's also connected to the psychology of Carl Jung on some levels. I'm not sure if that's a different branch of what you're talking about or if this is part of it. But certainly this idea...
No, it's perfect. Yeah, it's certainly connected to that. Absolutely. I can speak a little bit about that. So go ahead.
It would. That would be great. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Dr. Jean Houston certainly acknowledges the deep work of Carl Jung and Pierre Chardin. I can't say his name right. I guess Pierre Chardin. And then just Joseph Campbell, the famous mythologist. You're familiar with that work, is that right? Joseph Campbell,
yes.
And
yeah.
Bill Moyers. Okay, the Power of Myth series that made a big. It made a real big impact on me, Lauren. I watched that back in the 90s. I watched the videos. Joseph Campbell made an absolute profound impact in my understanding, and it really helped. Because he repeats, he shares, these are all connected knowledges. And so Carl Jung, the sacred psychology, Joseph Campbell has a quote. He says that you have to give up the life that you planned for the life that's calling you, or something to that effect. And so we're all, there's something deeper. There's something behind what I experience as this ordinary reality me. There's something. And so as I come into an appreciation of the nature of reality, the best that our tools in research and science has been able to come with, as well as bringing in the indigenous and the ancient wisdoms that are plentiful but not well promoted sometimes, at least not for me. I just seek it out. But there's something behind me. I mean, there's something aside. It's something beautiful and sacred and extraordinary, and yet I didn't know how to access that. And I just felt this horrific pain most of the time, and tremendous angst and depression and not even want to live. And I just held on to this hope that someday my life would be worth living. And I just hope against hope and just hang on one day to the next. And I also asked for help. Some people don't ask for help. In the military, it's really tough. You know, the VA promotes all the time. It takes the courage of a warrior to ask for help. And a lot of people in our rugged individualist society we'd rather die than ask for help. And a lot of people do. They commit suicide or they let themselves die other ways, you know. But anyway, sorry. So now there's a point for me to give this reference for deep trauma and disorientation. And so I want to share a quote from Dr. Deepak Chopra, who is an Ayurvedic doctor. You're probably familiar with him, right? Deepak Chopra?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So I was in Bellingham at the YMCA last year, and I saw a quote at the front desk. It was just was wonderful. Here it is. All great changes are preceded by chaos. I thought, wow, that's so awesome. That means I'm on track.
right in line there, right? Everything.
Yeah, it's like, everything. Whoa, this is so awesome. I mean, it's painful as hell, but something really important is happening here. I'm having a massive tectonic plate shift within my depths of myself. And this is where Carl Jung, see, he brings in the subconscious or the unconscious, and then we talk about archetypes of humans is very, very deep. And Campbell brings out beautifully that across cultures and time, there's recurring themes that repeat themselves, and yet those societies never had contact with each other, and yet they're undercurrents of somewhat similar themes, and so that's very reinforcing, and that's what Campbell really helped me to see, that there is coherence and there is something deeper there, that our modern ways can overlook or completely not see at all, say it's not real. But let me collect my thoughts here. We were asking about sacred psychology. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, and I just want to interject back to the quote that you gave about Campbell. I think that that's great, of this idea of what you planned for versus the life that you planned for versus the life that you are being called to, or something like that. And
yeah,
that this chaos really is the primordial stuff that makes what comes next, right? That you need the chaos in order to get to whatever is coming afterwards. And so I think these are just really important concepts for people to think about. Because I know that there are a lot of people right now who are listening, who are in this chaos, who are experiencing a lot of pain and despair and loss and chaos, and that things aren't going the way that they necessarily may be planned or wanted. So how do you get this to work in your life? How does this happen? How do you use this kind of information to switch it around and be able to tap into that which is sacred for yourself, and yet be able to draw on this ancient knowledge of sorts?
Thank you, Lauren. That's such a beautiful question. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And I just honor every listener here. You know, Brian Tracy is one of my favorite trainers. He said, be kind to every person you meet because we're all carrying a heavy load. Now, that word kindness is, I think that I'm going to bring that out for a second. And I just love the Buddhist philosophy of loving kindness. And I think that that is just the most profound. I love the word used, primordial. If we could just have a posture of loving kindness towards ourselves, really a ground of being, allowing myself to be, and now this is mindfulness meditation. I learned from my therapist that behind my thoughts and emotions, which with mindfulness practice, I can witness or observe my thoughts and emotions moving across the landscape of the sky of my awareness, you know, like clouds. And so I can, with practice, notice my thoughts and feelings, but practice learning that there's a distinction. I am not my thoughts and feelings. And I'm taking the DBT program, the Dialectical Behavioral Therapy, which teaches mindfulness practices. And this, there's a whole other topic about emotional intelligence, the new brain science coming into all those wonderful emerging fields of knowledge. It's just such a fabulous time to be alive, and yet we have so much chaos to move through. So anyway, it's an extraordinary question. I want to honor that question, Lauren, because that's so important. Let's see. So I also wanted to acknowledge how deeply impacted Robin Williams' death hit the nation. And I was talking with someone that I was walking with today, it was a very big deal, and it was something that just is disturbing, because America loved Robin Williams, and even President Obama said that he touched every part of our lives, and is such a talented, brilliant, wonderful human being, and yet how did he end up committing suicide? And he's a role model for, and so on. And so what's all that about? And that's
a role model for
unfortunately.
What?
I say, what's all that about? You know, with Robin Williams. But I'm just saying that you're right. There's a lot of pain there. And Robin Williams just tapped, or he touched on that deep dilemma, that horrific place that people elect, for some reason they lose themselves, they're lost in their own, whatever happens to drive a person to suicide, he succumbed to that, is my understanding. But I'm just acknowledging that was a big loss for the nation, and it puts us in a situation of why, right? Would you agree with that so far?
I think so. I mean, I don't think that we actually know that, I think that that's what's being reported. I don't think that that has been confirmed, but
okay.
certainly the conversation that stemmed out of that did leave a whole lot of whys and a whole lot of questioning as to what this was about and what happens. I think that it also drew a lot of lines for people as to how people feel about what that means what one's own rights over one's body are and things like that. But I think it did leave many people seriously questioning things, and then it left a lot of other people just using it to further the agendas. So I think it was complicated. I think that was actually one of the last when that was happening was one of the last shows that I had prior to tonight.
So
I think it definitely did take a toll on people, and that there was yet another level of split into it. But certainly this is something that happens every day. And there are plenty of people, you know, that have this debate amongst themselves as to whether to live or to not live. And I know that when people make that choice, it leaves those of us left with all kinds of feelings. And I know that there are people who are experiencing some of that right now. And so how again, do you do this loving?
Yeah, I was going to come back to that, yeah.
Or this mindful meditation, or this idea
Well, I was going to offer a quote. Oh, sorry, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Yeah, no. I mean, I say it not nastily. I mean, I know sometimes that my tone. I'll attribute that to that I'm from Brooklyn. Okay, but this idea of, you know, loving kindness, being able to fix things, or, you know, how do you reach across for somebody who may not be able to hear these kinds of messages in a way that is hearable, or is it just that you only hear it once you're at a point of where you can hear it? So these are parts of my questions.
Okay. Yeah, I want to share something. I mentioned loving kindness, and I want to quote from Buddha. Buddha is quoted to have said, "You, as much as anyone in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection."
I'm going to repeat that. You, as much as anyone in the entire universe, deserve your love and attention. So, Lauren, I am propose something here that it's a Jefferson lecture. I have a little book here somewhere, but the title of this book is titled It All Comes Down to Affection. I think that's it. I really do. I really think that affection is the key to the doorway of a better future, of a new life. And but let me back up, though, and say that it's not necessarily easy to come into affection when I'm in deep trauma or when I have extremely toxic negative emotions, which I have had. I'm still healing from that. And so one of the things that I have reflected on, Lauren, is that for me, it's been a profound unlearning experience. Huh. And what I mean by that is I've had, if I use the metaphor of drilling for oil or drilling for something even deeper, now I'm going to also borrow from the deep archetypes of the unconscious that the species to share that Carl Jung and Campbell and Jean Houston talk about. That so for me, that it was like I'm drilling down way past the foundation into the substrates, into the tectonic plates as deep as I possibly can into my own humanity, and getting rid of all the effing crap that is blocking me from my own magnificence. I'm going to share a beautiful quote from a popular author, Neil Donald Walsh, the author of several books, but his first one was called Conversations with God. Now, I happen to be down in Medford, Oregon, and the VA facility down there for almost a year, and I went to the church that he was a guest at, and so he signed my book for me, and he also, it's very humorous, he shared, really quickly, he shared about making a shift in ourselves, and he referred, so he said this, he said, "You mean you do the hokey pokey and you turn yourself around and that's what it's all about?" It was so fun the way he did that.
That's also the dance they do at Occupy protest when the police are saying you can't cross this line. So you put your right foot in. But yeah, okay, so what happened then?
Okay. Well, he wrote a beautiful invocation for me and it said, "Tom, many blessings. Go now and move into the experience of your own magnificence." And I just sat with that for, I'd say, about 15 years now. And I'm, you know, every word was carefully crafted, in my opinion, and very intentional. Let's go through that, because I really think that that has great value for the listeners here. And so, Lauren, many blessings. Go now and move into the experience of your own magnificence. Okay, so we acknowledge you, Lauren, as a person. Now, I'm going to borrow a quote since we're talking about person. I'll think of this flop for a minute, but he said, "A person is neither a thing nor a process, but an opening through which the infinite or the absolute manifests." I'll repeat that. That was Martin Heidegger. "A person is neither a thing nor a process, but an opening through which the infinite manifests." So that's something that comes back to sacred, doesn't it? That comes to say that just nails it for sacred psychology. I'm not just a blob of biology. I'm not even material. I'm this energy with intention spinning at different vibrational patterns.
Okay, I will accept that.
You accept what?
I do accept that. But
say more.
Yeah, but how do you get beyond that?
Okay, well, I'm kind of getting there. So let me finish. Will you be patient with me for a minute?
Yes, I'll try.
Okay, I'm going to go back. For me, Lauren, I'm, you know, linguistics and wordsmithing, I'm very picky. Sometimes way too picky with words, but I have an intention behind it, and that is that you know, writers, you're a novelist or whatever, you know how a phrase can be extremely, like, loaded and compacted?
We share this, yes. Yes,
yeah.
I'm known
so,
for
so
my pickiness about
I'm
words.
I'm going to open up each one of those words. So, Lauren, many blessings. Go now and move into the experience of your own magnificence. Okay. So go now is an invitation for action. So for me, now this also gives me a clue into the nature of reality, the nature of God. You might want to say, for me, I was able to shift from God being some kind of a construct to being a movement. And then Dr. David Bohm, as a physicist, also talks about the implicate order and the explicate order. The implicate order is that becoming is a potential that hasn't manifested into reality. So, and then he also, this is very important for me, Lauren, to just say this, that we are nature expressing. I'm not watching nature. I'm not observing. I'm not separate from nature. I am nature. I am life expressing. Now, that's very important to me. That is extremely healing for me in every level, and it eventually seeps up through my emotions, and I come into crying and profound gratitude and praise and worship. I don't even have to believe in God. It's just it's just coming into existence itself. But the existence is later. First of all, for me, it's a theoretical shift of coming into now that point I made that go now and move. So going means you're taking an action step, and moving means that there's movement. So I was just trying to layer that behind those words as an invitation to a worldview that I wasn't familiar with. Okay, I'll pause while you respond and go from there.
No, I think that this is good, and I just also think that there may be a little bit of confusion amongst people. So this radical shift in thinking of what we're talking about, right? It's so simple, and at the same time, it is so nearly impossible to shift in this way that we are energy that is bound up within these walls, but still can break free from that we are not simply a matter of some biological mechanism, but that we have something greater inside of us that can be motivated to live in some other kind of way or something like that. There is a caller on the line from area code 970. 970, are you there?
Hello, Penny. This is Maria. Can you hear me okay? I'm trying a new phone.
Hello, Maria. I can hear you. How are you?
Okay. All right. I'm really like what I believe his name is Tom is saying. I can't
remember. Yes, we are online with Tom Clute. Yep.
Yeah, go ahead.
I am a big fan of DBT myself, as well as Neil Donald Walsh. And there is definitely both in any regard to any diagnosis that psychiatry has out there, there's definitely a regard to how a person is in touch with themselves if they truly care and adore themselves. And, I mean, it took me 20 years to really catch on to all that. The thing is people have been, when they're told they have this diagnosis, whatever the diagnosis is, they are told that they're not personally responsible for their diagnosis, that it's a brain and chemical imbalance, and it takes all responsibility out of their hands, except that's the very thing I believe, at least for myself, I needed. I needed to become responsible for my feelings. And it's okay to feel overwhelmed. All those feelings are okay. It's what you do with those feelings. And it wasn't until I had really good DBT teaching that I really learned that no matter what it is that set me off, it's all temporary. And DBT also taught me that, you know, there's more than one way to look at things, you know. And do I have all the facts before I jump into conclusions, you know? Suicide has been a lifelong problem with me, but not anymore. Not that I don't get suicidal thoughts, but I no longer think or have that I must act on it urges that I had. I think the antidepressants actually made those urges more, because after starting the antidepressants is when my suicide attempts became more frequent. And I became more rapid cycling bipolar mania. But when I decided that the medications, which never really worked, they were always playing hopscotch with my medicines, it wasn't until I explored my whole self. And when I learned that, yes, I have this mental health diagnosis, but it's not all out of my hands. It's not in someone else's hands. I mean, when I first came into the public mental health system, it was talk to your therapist, talk to your case manager, tell people. If you feel suicidal, go to the emergency room. And all I got was, wow, she's on our radar. She's a frequent flyer. Try to get her not to come in. And I would go desperate to the ER, and they would say, go home and work it out all by yourself. You've been to the hospital too frequently. Hospital won't help you. So they create their own problems. They train you. Go to the ER. Call the therapist. You're depending on other people to get you through those suicidal, mania, depression times, whatever. At least that was my life. Those were my symptoms. But whatever your diagnosis, whether it be schizophrenia or bipolar or, you know, I also have eating disorders. But the thing is, when I realized that I am responsible for part of this and not everybody else, did I really recover? And then when I decided that psychiatry really, I mean, the whole aspect of psychiatry is a fraud is really new within the last year. But I eventually knew the medications weren't working. Now it isn't just that those medications didn't work for me. Those medications really don't work for anyone. Those medications are a lie. It's a whole system to get people dependent on drugs that cost money and the government, you know, and everything else. And what you were saying, I really could relate to. And you were talking about Robin Williams. You know, I'm a little bit like Lauren in that I'm not sure it really was suicide. It could be, you know, whatever, and only him and God know. But there are people out there that have put suicide in such a big light since his death that it became, it's people or organizations are using it to gather people into mental health, to get treatment, to save the lives of those wandering souls out there. And psychiatry itself is not the answer for those people who have suicidal feelings, which people, if I said my last words in the world would be, it would be suicide doesn't mean you have, feeling suicidal does not mean you have a mental illness. Because that's why people don't go and get help or talk to someone, because they always assume I have to be mentally ill if I could even think about suicide. And I really think thoughts of suicide is common to every man, woman,
Maria?
Child, whatever. So
Maria, this is Yvonne Smith. I don't know if people realize it, but today is supposed to be World Suicide Prevention Day. And I identify with everything that you're saying. In fact, for years I had suicidal thoughts, and then I moved up to homicidal thoughts. That was the improvement, because I had to say that I wouldn't do it unless I would, you know, have other people to follow me like Egyptians. But one of the things that I heard Tom talk about was very helpful to me when he said moving to your own magnificence. Part of my suicidal ideation had to do with the belief system that I had was indoctrinated as a child. And when I rejected all that religious hocus-pocus, and I know that it might have value for many other people, but when I rejected some of the, you know, a lot of times religions have some very negative self-talk that they give to people. When I rejected that, and as he said, moved into my own magnificence, I saw myself really as a god of my own self. That really helped, and that took a long time. That wasn't until in the last 10 years. And I really believed, as you said, I wasn't taking responsibility for my own self. I was leaning on psychiatrist and medication, because I felt as though I was told, well, they are, you know, going from the faith belief when they said, you know, there is a higher power and everything else will work it out. And then I translated that, well, these are people of science and they will be able to give me the right medication. You know, it worked for a while. I couldn't sleep, but then I couldn't get up either. So I really identify with that, because it seems as though, you know, sometimes we get one thing, whether it's religion, whether it's drugs, and we're not allowed to think for ourselves. And when we start thinking for ourselves, or at least this is my experience, I can't speak for other people, when you start thinking for yourself, you know, very deeply, and I think that's what Tom was thinking and talking about. I'm not a well-read person on Campbell or, what is it, Chopin Tour, but this kind of stuff does make sense to me, that you kind of realize that you have responsibility for your own self, and that no drugs, no doctor, or whatever else, it all comes down to what you're going to do for yourself. So, Maria, I really identify with everything you're saying. That forced me to call in.
Thank you so much. I'd like to respond. Is that okay?
Yes, please. And I guess
yeah.
I just want to interject, and I want this, like, in the world, in the view of the world, that right now everybody else in the world is watching the president deliver his address to the nation, and I caught a glimpse of the background of it, and it seems that the arrows are up and the laurel leaves are hidden. So this is not simply just about psychiatric diagnosing. This is about, as a society, what are we doing out there, and how can we bring it? Like Seth Farber was talking, that we have the messianic vision here. How are we the ones who are going to be able to change this ultimately and change up the way that the world is?
And I don't want people to come off the broadcast, because I'm going to tell you that the live presidential broadcast is going to be rebroadcast, and what
it's
going
to be rebroadcast over and over again, and it's going
I'm going to put a link to the rebroadcast up on your Facebook page.
I think that Tom, what you're talking about here, I think that this goes beyond just simply psychiatric diagnosis or dealing with psychiatric diagnosis, and these are some of the methods that we can be really using as a society to change some of the chaos that we're under at the moment, because we certainly are living in chaotic times. So anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt with,
thank you. I appreciate that. And I want to go back to, like, Vince Lombardi and John Wooden. Those are like football coaches that defined, the mastery level of coaching. And the thing that I remember John Wooden saying was, we always stick to the fundamentals. It's always back. We don't get fancy. We just do the fundamentals. Fundamentals, fundamentals. And that's been something that I'm still coming into, learning to get a daily – practice of self-care. Now, I listened to a bipolar coach here in Portland, Julie Fast. She's a national author and speaker and trainer, and she's a friend of mine here in Portland. And she says that for her, there's no way in heck that she would ever be able to keep a full-time job, but she is, with about 4 hours of self-care every day, all the mindfulness and the exercise and the diet and everything, she can pull off about 4 hours of actual work as an independent, self-employed person. So she was able to manage that, and that gave me hope. I have been diagnosed with bipolar myself and a few other diagnoses as well. And so I work with that. And I have found for myself, just as a side note, that I at this time accept medication for sleeping and for stabilization. I did try and go off before. I did try to lighten it. I may be willing to try that again with the help of coaches and things, but that's not my current. I'm willing to accept what I've been able to find works best for me. I'm not willing to jeopardize or give up my stability right now. That's very important to me. And whatever tools work, even if I don't like them or want them, I don't agree with them, if that's what the only thing I know so far, and I'm going to give myself time to make changes over a period of years, not months. Now, I brought that up about John Wooden and fundamentals. Now, I want to really offer some extraordinary value here. And to me, Lauren, simplicity is profoundly brilliant and beautiful. And Dr. David Bohm and the other luminaries, the simplicity of what they bring to the table is so extraordinary. It is absolutely transformative. Now, how do I invite my listeners and myself to come into that? There's some fundamentals that cutting-edge science is coming into. Now, as a social worker, it's a very important principle. And if I'm gonna preface this now, we're gonna salt the communication, which means you make you thirsty for what I'm gonna share with you. Now, this is important. Listen to this. If the only thing you remember from this entire session is that if you can get yourself to move from a place of isolation to connectivity, from a place of separation to community, that is the biggest gift you can give yourself. Now, that includes the community of yourself. That means intra-communication. And then, so there's two things. There's two things now. One was that movement from isolation to connectivity and from separation to connectedness. The other that comes to mind, what was that? I had that.
I'm sorry, I just want to back up. Isolation to connectivity, and what's the other one?
Yeah, well, it's a similar thing. I'm using the word community and connectivity, and so that's the positive. The polar opposite of that would be isolation and separation. So from isolation and separation to connectivity and community.
Gotcha.
That's really the journey of the heart and the mind connecting. Now, here's the other thing, Lauren, that's really been helpful, and I invite us to come into mindfulness breathing, which means we all breathe. But for me, mindfulness means I bring intention to my breath. I am attentive to my breath. I notice it. I bring my awareness to it. Even if it's for a second or 5 seconds, 30 seconds, a minute, and then build from there. Just to bring
that
intention.
You think you need to live on the West Coast to do this effectively?
What's that?
Yes. I think you need to live on the West Coast.
West Coast, does that help? Does that help?
I think that this is where a lot of us have struggled. How do you pay attention to your breath? How does that happen?
Well, you know, I was going to say that, you know, that there's a song by the Judds. It says, love will build a bridge between your heart and mind, right?
Okay.
And so that's the journey. For me, Lauren, it's a journey that my mind or ego or however you want to describe that process of we hear our incessant chatter, our self-talk, all that. That for me, it's learning, in my experience, that with practice, with compassion, with all these mindfulness practices, which there's plenty of research out there and tools out there for that. One specific example is Dr. Dan Siegel. he's written a book that he coined the term MindSight, MindSight, MindSight. The website for that is the title of a book and everything. So he actually, one of the chapter titles in that book is called A Broken Brain, A Lost Soul. So he makes the point that neurology and coherence have a connection, and if we can come into a healing of the actual understanding of how our mind and brain are interrelated and come into a literacy of our biological and neurological processes from his suggestions, which embraces the ancient and the modern in a coherent way, now we're on to something, okay? Now, so let's review now. We talked about coming from separation to connectivity and from isolation to community. Now, Jack Canfield's one of my favorite trainers, and in one of his book, The Aladdin Factor, which is about the power of asking, he's the author of the fabulous runaway bestseller, Chicken Soup for the Soul. So anyway, he says in that particular book, if you feel like you're a failure and you have no chance of success in your life, if you'll do this one thing, it'll be more powerful than anything else. He says, get around winners. Get around people who will encourage you. Get around healthy people that will speak to your greatness and call it from you and hold you accountable to grow in that direction. I don't care what community that is. I don't care whether it's a Jewish community or a Christian or a Muslim or an atheist. I don't care, as long as it has that element of affection and endearment and appreciation and drawing out. That's that. Now let's go back to that sacred psychology. Sacred to me, Lauren, means that there's something as, what's that doctor in which Africa, he says, reverence for life. There's something worthy here. My existence is worthy of being acknowledged and valued. And here's another word. It's a beautiful word, intrinsic. I have intrinsic value. That means I don't need an outside authority to validate me. Now, there's one more. There's so many things, but this is important. Coming into your own internal authority, your own sovereignty of will, the sovereignty of you. I have a trilogy of Ray Rice called The Treasure of You, The Agenda of You, and then The Audacity of You. If you come into the daring audacity of yourself and just, for me, now this is actually my story. Go back to my story so it helps reinforce this point, Lauren, and that is that I had to let go of being nice. Being nice didn't cut it for me anymore because my trauma came up was horrific. Well, I'm talking about a tidal wave storm of volcanic blasts of toxic rage. Are you following me?
Yeah, I gotcha.
Okay. So you know what I had to do? I had to let it out. And I just dumped. And I vomited all over everywhere. And I had to go to the hospital, outpatient intensive hospital. And I get a lot of good help. Now, I know other listeners, they've had a lot of trauma, but for me, for whatever reason, I felt supported by my social workers and things. But anyway, the whole point is that you gotta let yourself detoxify. And you got, and also here, so one more thing, and that is, that's important to identify that we have a lot of toxic elements and aspects of our society, and so we want to create safety for ourselves, safety checks, safety barriers, detoxify. Limit the amount of negative that you absorb every day. Try and limit it and then infuse more positive. Okay, I'm ready for responses.
So I heard Yvonne,
I heard you say something about how do you detoxify? I mean, you drew a line between yourself and your medications, and then you draw a line between yourself and a social worker. Now, how do you detoxify?
The first thing you do is just reduce negative input. Now, for a lot of people, they watch the news every day or other things that are, I don't mean to be judgmental, but they can be time wasters. Try and get out in nature, for example. Trade some time on the computer on social media and try and actually have real conversations with real people on the phone or in person. That's a great way to start.
You do need to live on the West Coast.
Yeah.
Okay, three more about that. I don't remember that following.
Question, suppose you're not fat. Suppose somebody who, people have people listening on the line, suppose you're not a person that has a lot of people around you. You do, you are a very busy person. You connect with people on the internet. You have some connections with people that are alive. But what I'm saying, what is the premise? What is the, what are you trying to get out? Why are you trying to detoxify from? What are you trying to, when I think about detox, I think about someone trying to expel something from themselves. I can understand not wanting to
well,
be around.
Well, yes, it can
people.
Be both and simultaneously. Let me throw this preface in here. Everything I share is my personal experience. Any opinion I give is my opinion. It may not work for anyone else. I'm hoping that I can shed some encouragement. If all I can do is be a massive encourager tonight, that's my goal.
I'm asking you to share, and if you don't feel comfortable, it's fine. What do you detoxify yourself from? You made reference to news. You made reference to social media. What is the toxicity of these things?
Go ahead. Finish your question, please.
I'm asking that. What's the toxicity of these things? Because
okay,
as I often say, and what I do is one person's wellness
trigger. Well, for me, I want to make sure I have your full question. Go ahead, please.
What I'm saying is not for you, and this is not to pick on you, but to help other people to see what might be toxic to them, because sometimes what happens, people take a particular thing, a list of things, they say, oh, if I do this X, Y, and Z, but it might not apply to them.
That's right. Go ahead.
You made mention to some things. What do these things mean for you, and why is it that you need to avoid or get them out? That's what I'm asking. So people can look at themselves and say, well, you know, maybe for somebody else being very spiritual might be very positive. For somebody else, that might not be. They may need to detoxify that for that. How do you know that something's toxic to you?
Okay. What was that last question, please? Repeat
How
that.
Do you know something is toxic to
oh,
you?
Oh, okay.
And what do you
All right.
give them?
And what do you what?
And what so do you do about saying, it?
Okay,
right, right.
Thank you.
And how do you detoxify?
How do you what?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to respond now, okay?
Okay.
All right, so, you know, Earl Nightingale was a broadcaster since the 60s, and he founded the Nightingale Quinnent Corporation, and he grew up in low-income, impoverished environment. And he went to the library because he had this burning question. He says, what makes people successful, some successful and some not? And so he was, over a lifetime of research, he was able to come to his awareness, which he shared, Earl Nightingale's greatest discovery, that we become what we think about most of the time. That was his discovery. Okay, so, and then this is a quote he shared, which I think is pertinent to your question about detoxifying or anything else. He said, we all walk in the dark, and each one of us must turn on our own inner light. We all have a journey from ignorance to awareness. And so no one can tell anyone else exactly what works for them, because their interior multiverse is unique unto them. So I can't tell you, because I don't know what's inside of you, but I can share. And now here's the thing about human encouragement, human sympathy, human resonance, one human listening to another with intention to care and share, that's peer support, by the way, in my angle, is that we feel a resonance, a sympathetic resonance, and that is healing. And in psychology and psychiatry and therapy, my understanding is that the therapeutic alliance is it, and what informs the therapy that brings healing is the intention of kindness.
Well,
there we go back to kindness.
What I'm asking
now,
is to get back, give your, since you cannot tell people, use your own personal experience and
you want me to draw my own stories more? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. How do you come to determine something is toxic for you? Maybe give an example.
Okay.
How do you
detoxify? So for me, I inherited a very traumatic worldview. That means religious indoctrination. The Father knows best. I'm going to impose it. I'm going to give you a coercive theology. I'm going to impose it on you, and I'm going to tell you what to do because I know what's best for you. Okay? Now, I can only handle that so much. And then, actually, just last year, for the first time in my life, I stood up to my dad, and I blasted him with the F word and everything else for about 10 minutes. That was my coming to, you know what, with my dad. And so that was a real important thing for me. Now, I wasn't proud of it, but it was important to me to stand up for myself and say, you know what, you don't even know me, Dad. You have a perception, a construct, an image inside of you that you relate to me and it's convenient to you, so you don't have to listen to me. And I have the same towards you. We're both in our own little perceptive constructs of each other, and we haven't even come into relationship. So I was able to be aware of that my dad didn't even know me, and he was just projecting onto me, but he had a misdirected but important intention to help me, but he was shoving his rightness onto me, and it wasn't working for me. I needed to have space. I needed my freedom. He didn't know how to give me his freedom because, you know what, he was wounded too, and his dad was wounded too, and it goes back, and they just pushed it forward, and I pushed it forward. I lost my marriage because I was an asshole. Sorry. But I was. I wasn't trying to be, but that's what I inherited, and I just pushed it forward. So if there's one thing I would say that's really, I mean, I don't know what it takes to have a wake-up call, but sometimes the life hits you so hard that you fall on your knees. And while you're down there, you may as well try and pray as well as swear. It might be swearing, but just try and pray a little bit too.
So how did you detoxify yourself from the negativity that you had learned from your, what I'm hearing, and I might be wrong, so you tell me if I'm not saying what you're saying, is that you had a very indoctrinaire religious father, and some of those things were not necessarily good in having a relationship with a wife or a woman, and you followed what you had learned. How did you turn yourself away from that?
Well, a lot of it was trauma and pain and a lot of grief and a lot of suffering. And I just got tired of it after a while. I reached out and asked for help. I got so sick and tired of being sick and tired. I needed help. I was hurting so bad. I had to have relief from my suffering. I went to the hospital. I got a whole large, massive team of helpers. Now, that was my choice. Some people don't want to do that. I actually was probably over-dependent on that. But I did feel that I still have a large team of helpers because it's a massive, massive project for me to make a shift in habits. And then also for detoxifying, I through my research and study, I love to learn. I'm very curious. I have to learn. You know what? Pain does have a positive motivator. It drives me. Crisis is the best opportunity to make a change because a person is hurting so bad they're willing to do anything to get out of suffering, and if they can be aware of that and harness that pain towards a positive change. Now, that takes a lot of consciousness.
I agree with that sometimes. Yeah, that can be helpful. So,
but, no, I stumbled most of the time. I floundered most of the time. There were just a few epiphanies here. There were some retreats. There were some beautiful people I ran into. Life, I can't say this for everyone, but for me, it's my belief that every so often you get a break. You get someone that comes in your life that breathes fresh air into your atmosphere, and you get encouragement.
Okay? You get someone that believes in you.
Someone that sees you, because here's the deal. Until I come into my own self-respect, my own sovereign duty, and this now here's the deal for me. What's your name, ma'am?
Yvonne.
Yvonne. For me, Yvonne, it was coming into a massive but simple shift in worldview from separation to connectivity. Now, here's something I hope that you can, and listeners can take in. For me, a gradual shift from separation theology, separation cosmology, separation research, everything into a coherence, into a connectivity, into a seamless, integral cosmology. There you go. Because the implications will seep into your consciousness over time. That's what happened for me anyway, is that when I come into an appreciation from a purely logical, research-based, theoretical framework that indeed the indigenous had it correct, Chief Seattle, he said, the earth was not made for man. Man is from the earth. And so this web of existence, this interdependent web of existence of which we're all a part, we have a sympathetic resonance with all of existence. Let me share this. I hope this helps. For me, this is an indigenous worldview, a philosophy. And that is that the life force, whatever you call it, lives and breathes through all cosmology, through all things. And you know what? That includes you and me. Now,
Suppose that's not part of your belief system.
You said earlier that we're just biological beings. Go ahead. What you were saying, Yvonne?
You said something earlier about that people could accept this species even if they didn't believe in that. But suppose you just believe that we're biological beings. That, in other words, we're here, and we're just a blob of bone and flesh.
Yeah.
And you don't believe that. If you believe something other than that, that would make you go mad. But suppose you don't believe that.
Yeah, that separation worldview is what I would call it. It does drive fracture, fragmentation, separation, and degradation. All of that are outcomes of separation. That's my conviction.
Well, explain that to me. I don't have that much education. What's degradation? When you break that down to me, what do you say?
Degradation means that it hurts, it's destructive, it separates, and it is unethical. Now, ethics is an important word to me. Because the Dalai Lama uses the word ethics. He says, my religion is the religion of kindness. And then he also has a book out called Beyond Religion into Ethics. He really brings home ethics, because ethics is doing the right thing from a, I'm sorry, I need to learn, I'm, I apologize, I'm really practicing trying to speak in language that is that people can take in, and I'm still practicing how to do that. So tell me what you heard so far, and let's work together. Go ahead. And there might be some other callers waiting, too, so I'm happy to talk to other callers, but maybe we can finish this thought up. How can I be of service to you, Yvonne? What did you hear so far from me?
I don't know. You said something about degradation and some other words, and I didn't understand anything that was around.
Okay.
That's why I was asking you. To break it down, what I was saying is,
here's the point.
Suppose you don't believe that. Suppose you believe that here we are, we are here on Earth, we are bones and whatever else, and you don't believe all that. You don't believe that somehow that there's some other being or whatever.
Okay, beliefs do drive us. Beliefs do drive us, but to me, Yvonne, the bottom line is that beliefs, I want to be able to take action in spite of my beliefs, because my beliefs can be a barrier that I inherited. It doesn't mean I chose it. It might be that I just was born in dirty water like a fish. Fish is in contaminate. Degradation, in other words, degradation is contamination, right? You know that word. So I'm
what
in a contaminated
I need to
environment.
What do I need to move forward is what I'm asking. What do I need to believe to move forward?
Right,
okay.
And I think that's part of where for people who may not have a spiritual inclination or have any kind of connection to spirituality or a greater sense of being or any of it, all of this sounds like, you know, hogwash, like, you know, like it's just not within the realm. So for somebody who may have their mind curious about this, but still don't know how to go about getting there. What do you need to do in order to get to
that place?
All right,
I will. I'll respond to that. I'm going to borrow from SAMHSA. I'm going to borrow from SAMHSA. They have a definition of
from
recovery.
From SAMHSA.
Okay? Remember? Go ahead.
Sorry.
Calm down.
I'm listening.
Okay, so for me. Yeah, I'm not familiar with it. Sounds like you got some beef with SAMHSA.
just a little.
But what they say in that definition of recovery is that you come in to your own free will choice to connect with the community of your choice. You find the community that's nourishing for you, that allows you to be fed emotionally and socially and in other ways that are important to you. Find some way where you can be encouraged and nurtured. If you can somehow find people that can help you with that, whether it's a 12-step group or some kind of a meetup group, maybe it's hiking in nature, maybe it's exercise, swimming, whatever, there are groups of people who actually are healthy out there, and it might be new for us to go find healthy people.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is where I get caught up. I think this is where I get caught up with this incessant need for people to be happy and healthy. But I do think, I think that there's, personally, I think that it's cruel to suggest to people that you can be happy all of the time when the majority of emotions that people have the ability to feel are negative. And that happiness is really more of a figment of an imagination than that. That being and the idea that you have to be healthy, like I'm really opposed to. I think that people don't have to be healthy.
Well, I hope it wasn't my intention to convey an all or nothing. This is a big gray trend. This is a transition from great suffering.
Well, I got a lot out of this.
It's a transition. If I'm in great suffering and I need to throw up all these negative toxins that I inherited, or I somehow made a decision to be nice, which is actually a psychologist book called No More Mr. Nice Guy, and he shares the thing that boys, when they're young, at least some of them, they decide that if they're just nice enough, they're getting their needs met. Well, he says that's a trap. It's a psychological lie that we think that if I'm nice, so I got to practice being more assertive, not being an asshole, but learning to be an integrated human being, which means to speak up, to meet my needs, and to be assertive and say no. Those are real basic self-care skills. Now, to respond to me, I'm not saying to be a Pollyanna person or that I have to be healthy, healthy, happy, happy. But I do need, if I want to move from trauma and from toxicity, which to me means negative of some kind, for example, someone that's in a domestic violence relationship, if that's all they ever experienced was violence, then that's a whole new worldview. That's a whole new transition. Or someone that grows up in multi-generational poverty, they don't know, they've never had anyone perhaps come into their life and help them, take them to college and say, this is what it's like to be in a college cafeteria. This is what students do. And they learn over time that, I'm not so different than these people after all. Oh, maybe I could be like, maybe I could find myself. And that may not be the best example, but I'm just saying, it goes back to Earl Nightingale. He says, you've got to find your own internal authority. And that might take a lot of trial and error. I know it does for me. But for me, it's coming into reflection. Now, there's the amygdala in our brain, which is the fight or flight, which we've used most of our species history so far. We're still pretty much stuck in that. But we're able to come into the cerebral cortex, which is it. That's coming into the ability to pause. Two words, pausing and reflecting. That means taking a moment to breathe and then reflect. And then after the pause, that's when my wise mind, that means the integrated brain is working together, the emotions and the rational thought. It's a wonderful
See, now you've totally... Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but now it's like... wait a second, why is, like, this deep spirituality stuff coming back into the brain? Like,
no, that's not okay. Well, okay, now let me finish. I'll listen to your question because I want to understand what
no,
you're
that was
about.
It.
And by the way, this is dialogue. For me, this is
yeah.
dialogue. I'm not trying to preach at you. I'm trying to share
no,
with you.
No, I don't think anybody thinks that. Yeah, no, I'm just saying this is, yeah, this is, it just strikes me as odd that there would be this really deep spiritual conversation, and then ultimately it would wind up being back in the brain as to how the brain operates.
Okay, well, that's a worldview shift, because for me, and Dr. Dan Siegel supports this, that, and then also Dr. Daniel Goleman, he's written several books, one's called Emotional Intelligence. Then he has a new one called Working with Emotional Intelligence and several others. So for me, we're coming into a better scientific understanding of the emotions, and it's far, far, far deeper and more integrated than we thought. Emotions are, they actually, this is my belief, and I think they would back this, is that emotions, including learning to have empathy, that's what makes us human. And that's a developmental, that's a biological attachment and bonding and development of the brain's capacity to learn how to have empathy. We have a lot of violence in our society. We don't really have too much of a language of peaceful conflict resolution. The tools are out there. Dr. Marshall Rosenberg has a wonderful 40-year training now called Nonviolent Communication. It's right on YouTube. Got the free training. So all that's there, but I've got to learn about it. If I'm not aware of these things that are all around or available, then it's as if it didn't exist for me. Now, do you mind if I go on a soapbox for a second?
Go ahead.
Okay. Now, I'm going to talk a moment about learning. Okay? And I think this is really core, because if I want to move from suffering to less suffering and eventually into a sense of peace and then even gratitude for being alive rather than wishing I was dead, I've got to do something. I think it's called learning, and learning is the most natural thing unless it's stopped by some negative people. Like, for example, wouldn't it be horrific if a parent spanked and punished a child every time they fell down when they're trying to walk? Well, that's ridiculous. Learning, so failure in school, we learn a lot of conformity. We learn a lot of things. We lose our natural curiosity, and we are afraid of making mistakes, okay?
Agreed.
But learning is all about – so anyway, let me try and make – I seem to use a lot of words and go off on tangents. But for me, taking an intrinsic motivation – now, those are fancy words. Dr. DC in his TED Talks talks about this. But intrinsic motivation means you're doing it for you. You're not doing it for any other reason that you want something, and by golly, you're going to learn how to do it, and that's moving out of learned helplessness. These are all psychological words and constructs, but I hope they're helpful. Anyway, the whole point is that, oh, I know. Oh, here we go. My therapist, I cried when he shared this, because it was the beginning of my dialectical behavioral therapy with Dr. Marsha Linehan, University of Washington, been 3 years ago for herself. She actually came out recently with that. That was for herself, that her extreme emotions. Anyway, so that's been around for 30 years now. It's worldwide evidence-based, and the VA uses it as well. It's expensive. Anyway, I'm in it. Now, my therapist said, I cried when he said this. He said, no matter how traumatic or painful my history is, I am capable of learning new skills. I cried when I heard that because I had hope. Wow, I don't have to stay stuck forever. I don't have to be limited. So that's, to me, I got excited about learning because, and also we're in a, you know, so this whole thing about learning, it puts you in the driver's seat. It puts you in charge, but you have to want to learn, and it's kind of crushed out of us in our compulsory education system sometimes. So that's a process of healing right there.
So Tom, where did you start at? When you said that you, when you came to the revelation that you had to learn, where did you start? Where did you go to?
Repeat your question, please.
Where did you go? You said you had to learn. Where did you go? I mean, I'm not a person that's read all that stuff that you have, but if someone else is listening, where did you go to learn?
Oh, okay. Well, it depends on where you want to go. I mean, there's no lack of opportunity. I mean, I use Google every day, multiple times a day. If I have any question at all, I Google it.
So you have you haven't abandoned the internet as a learning place.
You see, if I don't have the internet, then what do?
I said you haven't abandoned the internet. I heard you say something about social media earlier. So you have
I'm just saying that we don't want to only do social media. I mean, for example, I read an article, which I agreed with, that this writer, editor, was saying that that our smartphones are not equipped to convey the human nuances of our vocal communication and our body language. They're not equipped. They're there to transmit sound bites, not actual human nuances, very subtle. So we miss all that, and younger generations have to learn to practice actual talking. Actually, I saw a Facebook post. It's a cute Facebook post that says, "Want to know what's really sexy?" And the answer is a real conversation.
Tom, I just wanted to, I totally get where you're at, but I also get Lauren and Yvonne because I'm from the East Coast also, and it took realizing that my understanding of happiness was misconstrued because, you know, society says you're either happy or you're sad and nothing in between. And you're a dialectic DBT guy. What did we learn in DBT? It's not black and white. It's somewhere in the middle. And there are certain techniques we learn in DBT that says, oh, it seems odd, but you can have opposing thoughts at the same time. And that is not wrong. It needs to be processed. And where do you learn, Yvonne? We do it every day by, you know, the internet. I mean, I started out at the library when I was a kid. I always wanted to learn. I found that my biggest problem in getting where I needed to go was the willingness to learn all things. You know, that whole thing that Lauren talks about and I hear in the community a lot is full disclosure, okay? Well, you know, when the psychiatrist said to me, well, you know, you have a chemical imbalance, this is not your fault, I didn't need to hear anything else. I thought he was God. I thought he knew it all, and I fell for it. It wasn't until these drugs didn't help and made things worse, actually, that then I look for more. But it's to be open to, you never arrive. It's all a journey. You don't
it
ever
is.
Get
yes.
to the end.
I would reinforce that. What was your name, ma'am?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, can you repeat your name?
That's what people forget. You never arrive.
Maria.
You never finish.
Maria, thank you.
Yeah, you never finish. And you're never happy, and that's it. Now you can be happy for the rest of your life. You may only have moments of happiness in the day, but that is perfectly the way it's supposed to be. You're not meant to be happy on a consistent high level throughout the day or in your life. It was never meant to be that. Being human doesn't mean being happy all the time.
Yes, I would agree with that. I would agree that the range of emotions is vast. And the mainstream idea of happiness is a pretty narrow band. So we get outside of that band, and then we get pathologized and put in a hospital or a jail or something because society can't handle it. But that reminds me of another Facebook post, which I kind of liked. It said, I don't go crazy. I am crazy. And I occasionally go normal once in a while. I kind of like that one. But, so I hear you. Let's see. Let me pause for a moment. Lauren, would you please give me a question? All the things we've heard, could you kind of bring back to where and how much time do we have left? How are we doing for time?
Well, we have just a little bit of time left. I mean, I think we've covered a phenomenal amount of information tonight and just a breadth of possibility for people thinking about alternative ways of going about doing things and perhaps looking at a different kind of spirituality for reaching across and connecting in community in a way that they may not have before, and like stepping out of that isolation and separateness and really coming toward coming togetherness. I think that this concept of, I mean, Jungian psychology, of course, I really like and I have always liked, so I'm curious to learn more about this field of sacred psychology, which I think there has something to be in. And I, you know, one of the things that you said early on in the conversation was this Campbell quote around that you have to come to the life that you planned for or wanted isn't necessarily the life that you're called for. And I think that that kind of awakening of where people kind of come to terms with where they're at. That being said, I think that there's also a lot of things that are sometimes a little hard for people to grasp and get their heads around, and how to use things like mindful meditation or the idea of loving kindness as a solution to things. As this is happening, as a society, we're just in such a terrible predicament as to where we are, and certainly nobody is thinking with intention when we're walking around in our daily days, and very few people are communicating in these ways and connecting. And young people growing up, obviously we've talked about this before about on the show, about one of the drawbacks of technology is really eliminating these human interactions that other people have. But, you know, as we've been talking, I got an email, a math email, not an email direct to me, as if Congressman Tim Murphy was really reaching out to me individually. As a matter of fact, Congressman Tim Murphy still has not returned any of my calls or his people who organize his media appearances. But, you know, part of what he's gotten a little reprieve, and he also is getting involved with the what is occurring with the Islamic State and the potential caliphate that is being brewed. And he writes that brutally killing and torturing anyone who does not conform to their version of Islam. We have seen the savagery of the Islamic State in the appalling treatment and ultimate beheading of American journalists James Foley and Stephen Sadloff at the hands of black-hooded IS terrorists. And as I'm reading this, I'm thinking to myself, brutally and killing and torturing anyone who does not conform to their version of psychiatry. We have seen the savagery. Right? So we have a small reprieve, and Murphy has redirected his attention, at least briefly, toward Islamic State and trying to get involved, and wants to know what people think the U.S. response to the threat of radicalized terrorists should be. I guess the same way he thinks people should have some kind of response about what the threat of radicalized activists should be. And there isn't this honesty that's occurring inside of any of the dialogue anywhere. And people are using these things however they like in order to push their messages forward. And I do think that things like loving kindness and mindful meditation and developing a greater sense of emotional intelligence could help our society in a larger strain in many ways. And certainly the separation that people feel and the lack of community or connection that people feel to community is encouraging people stepping away from instead of becoming part of.
Well, that's sometimes what happens to people who are very active in consumerism or mental health movement. Sometimes what happens is they become a deficit to the system. Maybe they become a danger to the system, and they will try to isolate them. And I've seen this happen where people have told people they become peer specialists. They could not associate with a specific person, and that's what they do. That's why you really cannot be dependent. You have to have supports and things that have nothing to do with mental health. It's great to have a good therapist, to have a good social worker, to have a good peer support person, but you also have to say, just as Tom said, have a connection outside of the clinical mental health world, to have a connection that you, that's what I heard him say, you have a connection of a community that you belong to, because that's the key, for me, it may not be for other people, that's the key to move, for me to moving forward, was to reject these negative authoritarian religious ideas and to find connectivity with several communities. So it's just like individuals, communities sometimes you're going to outshoot them because your ideology does not mix anymore. We all change. We're not the same people we were in our 20s or 30s.
You know, it takes a lifetime to learn, and I really like what Dr. Warren Bennis, he's a leadership guru, and he's retirement age now, and in his book, The Essential Bennis, he really advocates to become fully integrated human beings. That's really our life work, is to become fully integrated human beings. That's his opinion, and I support that. And
fully
then also
integrated
Dr.
in what?
Fully integrated human beings.
Oh, human beings. Oh,
yeah, a fully integrated human being. That, to me, that comes back to Dr. Eric Erickson in psychology about the 8 stages of human growth and development, Dr. Carl Rogers on his wonderful classic book on becoming a person. And so this coming, I really want to bring it back to you. It's the agenda of you. It's the treasure of you, the treasury of you, and the audacity of you. If you can come into the audacity of you and let go of other people's outside opinions, as long as you're safe and things, but really, really, and then we need to talk and share and get this stuff out. That's what dialogue is for. We're doing it here now as well as in person
do you
any other way.
Do you have to be able to, are you going to provide us with a bibliography? Do you have to have read all this stuff?
I heard so bad. I heard so bad and so long that I just had to help myself. That's what I chose to do. And I just went on this learning journey. And I'm grateful and excited. Now, I fall down frequently too. But you know what? That is our privilege, is to fall down. And I like what Les Brown, he says, if you fall down and you land on your back, if you can look up, you can get up. He's a motivational speaker. I like that, and it might take me a while to get up. I might rest and regroup for quite a while, whether it's in the hospital or in my bed or whatever, but that's where, now, I got a beautiful poet. His name is Mark Nepo, N-E-P-O. Beautiful title. It's also on CD. The title of the book is The Courage, it's called Finding Inner Courage. Finding Inner Courage. I think that's just core. We need massive doses of encouragement every day. That's the doctor's order. Massive doses of encouragement to yourself and to the people that you care about. And I also like the idea that they teach in the airplanes that if you have a crisis or if you suddenly everyone put their mask on, make sure you have your mask on first before you start helping others. That was one of the biggest things I've really had just recently come into, is that I'm responsible for my own self-care, and if I try and save the world or change other people or be worried and all frazzled and I don't take care of myself, then I can't. Then my battery is depleted, and I'm not empowered to do anything, including be healthy or rested myself. So that's a big learning for me, is just take time for you. Take time for you. Come in.
I think that's just so important, and I want to just, Tom, your website, if people wanted to get in touch with you or learn more about what you're doing and follow your endeavors there, is www.earthsharelearning.com, is that right?
That's right, earthsharelearning.com, that's right.
And so you'll be able to put information there, and then maybe we can also get some links.
Yes, the site is still under development. They can email me. It's earthsharelearning@gmail.com. That's earthsharelearning@gmail.com. The website's there. I still have to develop it more, but it has a welcome page and a little background, and then I'll work on that over the next few weeks. But you're welcome. That's at least a starting place.
That's great, and maybe we can get some of these links up that we were talking about throughout the show, the Gene Houston's website and the sacred psychology stuff. And
I'll work with
and really
you on
start
that, absolutely.
To just get that information out, because, you know, one of the great things about the Internet, as much as technology is a drawback, is that it does hold a wealth of information that people can sit around and surf through and find information as they need. And at the same time, to be able to get this sense of this other radical shift in thinking, this other way of looking at the world, so simple and yet so difficult all at the same time. But sometimes it's just a matter of hearing that right quote, that right moment, that right thing that kind of jostles you into awakening and have you look at things in a different way, and that there is hope. I think that's where we always want to leave it, that there is hope that no matter what the chaos, that it could just be what's brewing for what's coming next, right? Like that quote you had mentioned earlier. Maria, I know you've been holding a long time, and I'm just wondering if you had any final thoughts before we wrap up. And Tom, if you would have just, after that, just be able to say whatever final thought you might have. And Yvonne, this
okay.
is the same. So, Maria?
Thank you, Lauren, for that. I just want people to know that I totally get what Tom was saying, but it is not in any way, shape, form easy, and everybody is on it their own level. I just lost a friend who just couldn't learn it fast enough before he lost his life to psychiatry. And I just thank God. Yes, that's sad, but I thank God that I have had the opportunity to learn in time so I don't die tragically alone and suffering. So that's the main thing that, for me, is that no one that I know or myself needs to die tragically alone or in any... I don't want someone to say, oh, I can't believe the way she died, you know. I want to be known for the way I lived, not the way I suffered. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria. Yvonne, any final thought?
No, I think that all this is good stuff. I say my final thought would be take what you can use and leave the rest.
Absolutely. So, Tom, in closing, what would you like people to just walk away with, the take-home note for you?
You know, Lauren, what was really helpful for me in my therapy training as a social worker was two pillars of a posture, a stance. One, it was a not-knowing stance. The other is curiosity. Those are two cousins I go forward with. So those are two pillars that I utilize, and Dr. Albert Einstein says it. So being curious, and there's a beautiful, simple quote that says, the best way to face the unknown is to not know. Allow ourselves to not know and be curious. And then the final thing I would share is know that there's something sacred inside of you that you're yet to discover. Your greatest life may very well be ahead of you, and pray and hope, and then take action towards that, and just know that it's a journey. It's not an event, it's a journey, so just breathe and go. There you go.
Well, Tom Clute, thank you so much for joining us in a great conversation tonight. Your website, www.earthsharelearning.com, earthsharelearning@gmail.com, if people want to reach you. Tomorrow night we will be back on 8 to 10 p.m. for open lines. We will be discussing the Murphy Bill and advances that have been made in recent times and the way to continue to combat efforts of those who try to promote the civil liberties of people being taken away in the name of quote-unquote help. If you have an idea for a show, would like to be a guest, or know of a human rights violation that you think needs attention, please give a call to the Talk with Tenney tip line at area code 718-273-8708. And I hope that you have a great day. All who are on the front lines fighting the fight, good luck. Good luck in court. Good luck winning your battles. And stay strong. Until next time, talk to you soon. Thanks so much, everybody. Have a good night.
You too, Lauren.
Bye,
Thank
Kenny.
You.
Bye.
Bye-bye.